that's funny. People are still here. They're still listening. And if you're still listening, what do you want to do, Dan? Where else do you want to go?
To thevalleyoutdoors.com.
Ava?
And Facebook.
Exactly, because we got cool stuff going on those sites.
You know, especially the connection with the map, the interactive map.
Yeah.
And I was just going to bring up, because I'm thinking of going out to Wyoming next fall, for those that are looking to hunt Wyoming next year, if elk is on the list, you need to apply by the end of January. So you only got about 4 weeks to put your application in. So I'm just going to give you a heads up to that.
There you go. Good point. And it's tough to keep on top of all the pieces and parts that are...
states like Colorado, you can still get over the counter. I mean, there's difference, but Wyoming is very, very different.
That's kind of one of those mule deer, same thing. You know, if you want to go for the antlered mule,
yeah,
but you can get the others later. So
I'm hoping to do antelope this fall, and that you have to have in by the end of May. So I got time on that.
Well, speaking of out west, I know they've been getting a ton of snow out west. I got some friends that are out there, and until I started working at one point and selling sleds a number of years back, I wasn't in the realization how many people from the Midwest go out to Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana and go snowmobiling.
Yep.
Wasn't sure. Now I know.
Yeah.
It is a mass exodus because the snowmobiling out there is just incredible. And story coming out of the Utah-Idaho border. Two brothers lucky to be alive this holiday season. They were caught in an avalanche that buried one brother under the snow. The avalanche happened on Christmas Eve in Steep Hollow area in Cache County in Utah. They were riding snowmobiles, and one of them triggered an avalanche. One of the brothers was carried about 150 yards before being fully buried, according to the incident report. He was recovered by his brother, used the transceiver to get it close enough to see a couple of fingers of a gloved hand sticking out of the snow.
He's Yikes. Lucky he saw that. Wow.
The elevation of the avalanche is about 9,000 feet. The area where it happened had a persistent weak layer. So for those of you who may not understand an avalanche scenario, when snow builds up on a slope, it will have various densities of snow. So you have multiple layers, different snowstorms come in, and what you'll have is a shear layer. It's not the quite the right terminology, but what ends up happening is you'll have one of the layers that is weaker than the others, and it will ride on the upper sections will ride on the lower. And once that breaks free and the tension's released on the top, then the whole thing lets loose, and then it's game on. You're on for a ride. He said he could see his hand, his gloves kind of poking out, waving. By the time I got to him, he was about two feet under, and he just cleared the snow away from his head, got his helmet off so he could start breathing again. See, that's the problem. The death comes from suffocation, and that's not a
so scary.
Not a good way to go.
No thanks.
They doubled up and rode out of the backcountry, and the one brother who was buried sustained minor injuries. They said they were extremely lucky. Number one, always access and read the forecast. The forecast that day was considerable avalanche conditions and the same danger, again, as it has been in the past this next coming week. Avalanche dangers in the mountains in northern Utah and southeast Idaho are widespread heading into this weekend. This is the crazy part, though. I will say this. You guys may not have seen this, but there have been a number of inbounds ski area avalanches this year already. One of them was at Steamboat. I've got friends that go out there quite a bit. I teach with them in our ski school, and they were out there when that actually occurred, and it was crazy because that was not by any means a normal experience or expectation in that area. So very dangerous situation. So be aware of your surroundings. Make sure that you have an EPIRB, you have some type of reader, and or your jacket has a indicator on it. Now, you don't have to have a EPIRB on you, but as long as you have there's an EPIRB patch that will, or a tab that is on your jacket, make sure you have one of those. I don't care what everybody says, no matter where you think you're going to go. The problem is, it's when you don't expect it and it's like, well, we can't make it this way. We're going to have to go this way. And then you're further into the backcountry than you think you were planning on being. So really a key piece to that. So
does that ever happen on groomed trails?
What?
Avalanches?
I mean, on a ski area?
Yes.
That's where this happened. It was in bounds.
On a groomed slope.
Yeah, it started in the woods and then went into a groomed area, and it was inbounds area.
Okay.
So all the inbound areas, they shoot with either a throwable explosive device.
Or a cannon.
Or a cannon. They have multiple mounted cannons that they put up. It's basically a howitzer. And they launch it, it hits, and then explodes. And you can see patches of dark where the explosion occurred. And what they do is they try to break it free in the morning. You'll see on heavy snow mornings, you'll walk outside and you'll hear the thundering boom going on. Two things. One is, boy, I wouldn't want to be there if that went. The second thing is, hey, I'm excited because the snow is going to be awesome.
Right.
So it's that good and bad scenario, but you know, it's those days you really got to watch out. The cornices, you know, so you have a mountain area where there's a lot of wind, it'll create a cornice, which is a ledge. And the ledge, if they break, and they want them to break off, once they break, then they can trigger the rust from impact and the slides, as well as just simply any flat slope type slides. I was in not a severe avalanche, but we came to a clearing at Copper Mountain. There was five of my friends and I, and it just looked like this massively amazing open area. We were coming through the trees, hit this open area back, and they called the glades. And we were coming through, I think it was the glades, and we stopped inside the woods before we got to the open area, and we were all standing there, and the whole thing, we all dropped a foot and felt it slide about a foot and a half and stopped. We're like,
ruh-roh.
Yeah, no. We got out of there, reported to the patrol, and he said, oh, that's cool. It says, yeah, it was a slab slide. We're like, and what's your point? Oh, that happens. I said, isn't that cool? We're like,
no.
No.
I got a different way of saying it's cool.
Yeah.
And that wasn't one of them. But, yeah,
change,
you know,
change of outfit.
So the other thing is, you see, I don't know if you've seen this, but I mean, obviously we're in a snowmobile season. So a lot of guys go out, they'll do what's called highlining. And they've done a lot of things that to sleds. They've turbocharged two-stroke sleds. They've turbocharged four-stroke sleds. They do anything they can to get more power to the sleds to get that altitude so they can climb. So what they'll do, Don, is they'll go from a base of this of a ridge all the way down at the bottom of the flat, and they'll run it up, and they'll turn on the bank, and they'll come back down. And if they're not careful or don't know the area or it hasn't been blasted, many times if it's a questionable area or prone to slide, what will happen is when they come back around, it'll let loose. And there's multiple videos. If some of you guys, listeners, want to go out and check something out, go check that out and watch some of the videos. You can find them on YouTube. They're absolutely the craziest thing ever. You've got a guy on a sled. The sled, it's triggered, and the only thing you can do is try to pull off to the side. The problem is the sled can't go because you're moving on it, and it doesn't –
The ground's moving with
it. Yeah, and you don't get any stability with the skis. So pretty doggone crazy is what I will say. So, and especially now with this week, the next 5 days, they're forecast to get 35 inches of snow out there. So lots of unrecreational activities going on out there. Snowmobiling is going to be one of them, but be safe. If you haven't seen the inflatable protection for avalanches, get yourself one. I know two people that were saved by that particular collar and inflatable deal. I don't know if you've seen it, but
no.
The biggest issue with an avalanche is you get thrown into the mix and you'll get once you're in the snow, you'll get churned up with everything else. And what this does, it's inflatable. As soon as you find you're in, you know, whatever it might be, avalanche-type slab, either it's slab or whatever, you hit the release on this, and it provides a inflation of like the suspenders life jacket, only it's way bigger on the top section. So what it actually does is it pulls you to the top and keeps you on the top of the snow through all the churning and whatever else, because you have more light surface area that's really not letting it drop. So the weight is, it's like buoyancy, really. And pretty incredible as far as the tools that you can have to help make a trip that much better. So
stay safe. Cool.
Yeah, very much so. Something I wanted to get to, I know there's a lot of guys that have talked about having fish and whatever for ice fishing. You're going to go do that. And how to prepare or how to help make them taste better before you package them up and cook them. And there was an article that just came out, and I thought it was quite telling. And of course, the saltwater side of it is where obviously a lot of the guys now obviously are fishing, that it makes a bigger difference. But one of the things that comes to mind across the board, I was looking at a lot of these, and a couple of them were a little surprising that I didn't realize as far as how not to ruin fresh caught fish. So let's dive in.
How not to ruin them.
How not to ruin it.
That's a good thing to know.
Yeah, it is. Draining blood or bleeding out the fish is one key piece to that. And the reason that you'll find this is a key, when you slice the
throat.
Yeah, cut the throat or the gills, depending on what you're going to do. All it takes is a snip from a scissors. Usually that's easier if you're not very adept with a knife.
I use the side cutters. It's much safer than a knife.
Yep. And so that works well. But what it does, bleeds out the fish, and instead of having all that blood that's in the fish, and a lot of times the blood will create that fishy flavor, and it also has a more of a red-colored fillet. Now, there's also a bloodline that's in the fish, and when I often tear or slice out the bloodline, it's called zippering. So if you have the fillet that looks like kind of a V, you slice either side of that V, grab one side, it peels off like a zipper.
Mm-hmm.
That removes the bloodline. So if you see that red meat that's on the back, it takes out quite a large area that, you know, maybe a quarter inch on the backside, and it's very narrow on the front side. That changes a lot of the flavor of the meat itself, and it improves it drastically. Temperature of the bleeding as well is important. If you have a situation where you've got a fish that you've caught ice fishing, if you have a bucket inside, throw it in the bucket. If it has water in it, let it bleed itself out, then throw it outside. It'll freeze up and everything will be fantastic. One methodology to do that, but really it's an important element really to let the fish swim and then have it bleed out that way. So really improves the fish flavor. Don't fight rigor mortis. You'll occasionally get excited or rush to process fish, although it's crucial for the molecular through the process of rigor mortis without disturbance. Late Jack Whalen, a fish smoking legend, spoke about the subject in Smoking Salmon and Trout. When the fish is killed, the muscles are at first relaxed when they're used up stored energy. When the energy is gone, the muscles contract, stiffen. After a time in rigor, the muscles again relax and stay that way. So according to him, the fish are especially susceptible to damage during rigor. Excessive heat or anglers attempting to straighten out a curled up fish can cause muscle tearing. The final fillet will quite literally look torn apart when you get it to the kitchen table. If the fish is curled up on itself, let it flatten out on its own. Process happens relatively quickly, and with patience, your fish will have the firm texture when fully processed. So I did not know that at all. Did you?
No.
When do you bleed your fish? I always put mine in live well, and just before I come in for the end of the day.
Just before I come in.
Then I bleed them, and by the time you get in, they're all bled out.
If I have a fish that looks a little weak, I'll bleed that out right away.
Yeah.
And just because that fish, if it passes, is not going to bleed at all. You're not going to bleed it out at all. It's
In order to bleed it out totally, it needs to have its heart pumping.
It needs to have the pumping. Yep. You were going to say something, Ava? I didn't mean to.
I don't ever clean fish, so I don't really like know the process. I just fish and enjoy
it. You like
them.
To eat fish, though.
Mm-hmm. Hey, and I like the fishing
eating's
process.
Eating's a big part of it. I got to tell you.
Cleaning it is a completely different thing and made me sad.
So the other thing, too, is they say fish are – I'm moving right along. Fish are like apples. He said they're highly susceptible to bruising if they're not handled carefully. And of course, just like a bruised apple, mishandled fish can be mushy and discolored. And one of the people from the Alaska Commercial Fisheries, they said they spent many, many summers on the famous Bristol Bay and appropriate fish practices in the Fisherman's Pride, a Colorado seafood company. They said that making sure they use padded mats under the seining nets, a lot of time is spent to make sure that they don't stack on top of each other because of the bruising. Targeting larger species, of course, that's going to be a key piece to it. And last but not least, eavesdropping and conservation of the Salty Dog Saloon in Homer, Alaska, they were saying that it's important to keep the fish dry. This is from a well-known chef in the area. He said the issue of moisture in the book, The Whole Fish, seems counterintuitive, but keeping your catch dry is the way to go. Humid, wet environments become breeding grounds for bacteria. Therefore, he says, keep the fish dry when you're packaging and doing anything additional with those fish. So it's an important topics.
Yeah, that's
sure.
That's key. We always dry ours with paper toweling.
Yep.
Both sides of the fillet. Try to get as much moisture off before we put them in
the old
vacuum shrinking
machine.
Yep.
The incredible shrinking machine. No, it works well. And they also put a little paper towel at the end of it to try and pull that out of it at the same time. Yep. So. Well, you guys, looks like we're not going to be talking to you till next year.
Right.
What?
Everybody.
Talk to you next year.
Yeah. Sad. Yeah.
Everybody have a happy new year.
Well, you know what? It's been a great year, you guys.
I really can't
thank you enough for your partnership and, of course, you guys at home for listening to us for another year. We get to hang out with you guys, banter about, and who knows what's coming up. So for the crew here at the Valley Outdoors, have a great one. Be a safe new year, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Outdoors Radio, brought to you by Vexus Boats, building dreams with an unequaled passion for excellence. Catch us next week, same time, same place. Have a great day on the water or in the field.